It's one thing to listen to doom and gloom about food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation. It's quite another thing to hear practical, immediately actionable advice from experts who can help you reduce the fear, anxiety, and burden of these problems.
Tune in now to the Surviving Hard Times podcast from the Finding Genius Foundation with Richard Jacobs. Before we begin, a note from our sponsor. I'm Richard Jacobs, Executive Director of the nonprofit Finding Genius Foundation and host of the Finding Genius podcast. In late 2016, I was rear-ended at 65 miles an hour by a truck on the highway, which sent me off-road into a ditch. The impact of the collision gave me a concussion and other injuries. At the hospital, a CT scan showed that I had thyroid nodules, which turned out to be cancer. It was then, when I had a biopsy in my neck, that I realized even if I was a millionaire, I wouldn't want a second or a third biopsy due to the pain and the invasiveness of it. And appointments at that time for thyroid experts were 3 to 6 months out, and I was worried about dying now, even if that was irrational. So because of this, I've decided to raise money to conduct a literature review on steroids, on the causes of anxiety and depression, a condition that affects well over 50 million people in the United States and hundreds of millions worldwide. Our goal is to create a codex, a guide, that reveals all possible treatments for anxiety and depression for people that live with the condition, or for loved ones that have it, as my wife and my son do. To find out more about our fundraiser, visit findinggeniusfoundation.org and click on Current Initiatives. And now, to our guest. Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Surviving Hard Times podcast, sponsored by the Finding Genius Foundation.
I have Sean Smuckler, PhD. He's an associate professor, also an associate dean of graduate and postdoctoral studies. He's the chair of agriculture and environmental faculty of land and food systems. So quite a number of designations. And we're going to talk about his research today into soil health and sustainable agriculture. So, Sean, thank you for coming.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. If you would, just give me a little bit about your background, and then I want to ask you about the research that you're doing right now.
Yeah, sure. Where to start? I guess I grew up working with my mother, who owned a landscaping business, and realized early on that I really enjoyed working with plants and soil, and did a degree at UC Davis in California, and got to witness firsthand as an undergraduate some of the amazing research that was going on at Davis, which is a land grant institution really focused on providing farmers with research and extension. And yeah, the labs that I worked in as undergrad were really focused on soil. And afterwards, I did a degree at the University of Washington, focused specifically on forest soils, a master's degree. And then went back to Davis for a degree in a PhD in ecology, and again, focused on soils. And since then, my research has really been focused on managing agriculture to enhance soils for maintaining productivity for future generations.
So what are some of the challenges today with soil? How is it being depleted, or, you know, is it becoming like literally completely unusable, or is it that it's becoming dependent on like exogenous fertilizers, or what's happening with?
Well, I mean, it's not that we're seeing a monolithic story across the globe. There are certainly places where people are managing their soil better than others. There's certainly some shining stars out there of people who are managing soil to make it better than the soil that they started with. But for sure, the trend seems to be that we're not treating our soil as good as we should. And you mentioned exogenous inputs such as fertilizers. That's often pointed out as one of the primary culprits there, because farmers they have access to nutrients that are readily available and quickly and effectively feed the crops that they're growing, but potentially the cost of their soil's health. And that's one thing that really needs to change, is a focus on crop productivity to soil productivity.
And so what does that mean? Again, what can we do to improve the soil instead of just using it and abusing it the way we have?
I mean, there are some very tried and true methods out there that can help rehabilitate or maintain a healthy soil. some of these methods have been in place since the beginning of agriculture, or even before. Some of these are pre-agricultural techniques. And basically the principles are to try to limit the amount of disturbance that we're causing to the soil. What we want is a soil that is basically a healthy ecosystem. There are organisms in the soil that are driving interactions and nutrient cycling that are critical to maintaining the functioning of that soil. And when we disturb the soil, we disturb those communities, and oftentimes to the detriment of the function. Other techniques would be to really protect the soil as much as possible. So make sure that the soil isn't blown away by wind or isn't washed away by water. Another important one would be to make sure that we're feeding the soil, making sure that the organisms that are in the soil are getting the sustenance that they need to function effectively. And oftentimes that's done by having a diversity of plants and making sure that those plants are able to get their roots down deep to where the organisms need them. The strategies that are being employed to maintain soil health.
Well, it sounds like, yeah, those are the things that need to be done, but what are the strategies? So how do you make sure that, you know, water infiltrates instead of runs off? So how do you make sure that all these things are accomplished?
Yeah, so one of the techniques that is often deployed by farmers is to use what's called a cover crop. Actually, to start, just to make sure that the soil is covered throughout the year. So during a production season, the farmer will grow a cash crop. And when the farmer is not growing a cash crop during the non-production season, say during a winter here in BC, it's critical that the soil is still covered. So they will grow what's called cover crop. This is a crop that is not necessarily going to have direct economic returns, but is specifically there to protect the soil during the winter months. But it also can ensure that some of the nutrients that were in the soil at the end of the production season are not lost to the environment, so that if you're planting a cover crop, that cover crop is soaking up any of the nutrients that are left over in the field and storing them till they're needed in the subsequent production season. It's also a technique to plant nitrogen-fixing cover crops. So legumes, beans, they have a symbiotic relationship with bacteria, so they can actually take nitrogen directly out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground. And that nitrogen can be utilized by the cover crop. And then in the spring, when the farmer is preparing their field for planting, they're turning that cover crop back into the ground and making it so that those nutrients are available for the cash crop. And, you know, so that has a number of benefits. And one of them is to reduce the reliance on the outside inputs of fertilizer.
Remy night guards are designed for comfort. Remy sends you an at-home impression kit and has a team of in-house dental professionals to make you custom, comfortable night guards that you'll forget you're wearing, all for 80% less than the cost at the dental office. Visit shopremy.com to get yours now and take an extra 20% off your order with the code GUARD20 at checkout. Remember, that's shopremy.com.
If you have nitrogen fixers, they grow what, during the winter, and then do you plow them in? Or how does it work where they leave nitrogen in the soil, but also removing the cover crop, I guess, when the time comes?
Well, so yeah, one of the challenges is to get that nitrogen mobilized so that the cash crop can utilize it during the summer. So if you're transitioning from a cover crop to a production crop, you need to think carefully. Farmers need to think carefully about how to do that. So one of the typical ways a farmer will transition would be to mow that cover crop and then turn the cover crop, plow that cover crop into the soil. And then the cover crop would be decomposed by the organisms in the soil making the nutrients available. But if you recall one of the principles of strategies for maintaining soil health was to reduce disturbance, you would want to try to minimize the amount of disturbance that you are inflicting during that transition period. So one of the research projects that my lab is working on is alternatives to that transition using traditional tillage techniques, trying to minimize the disturbance as we go into the cash crop.
Well, in no-till farms, what do they do when they have a cover crop in the off season? So what do they do to prepare for the next season?
Yeah, no-till would be a really good example of another strategy to reduce the disturbance. Some farmers, if they're conventional farmers, would have the option to use herbicide to transition. You could kill the cover crop with herbicide to transition to the next crop without actually using any tillage. Other no-till methods could be to actually just mow and then plant into the cover crop without actually disturbing the soil. There are specialized pieces of equipment now that can enable farmers to cut through the what we call as a mulch that's left on the soil surface and plant through that mulch. The experiment that we just ran with vegetable production system would be to use plastic tarps that would help to kill and to enhance the decomposition of the cover crop and enable the farmer to plant without tilling the soil.
Does the winter kill the cover crops, or that's not enough?
In some parts of the world, the winter can definitely kill the cover crop. In BC, where we're at, the winter here in Vancouver, the winter is fairly mild, so we can get a cover crop that can survive the winter. But yeah, there are definitely some parts of the world where cover crops are winter killed, and that transition becomes a little bit easier.
Is there a way to keep cover crops while you're growing during the growing season? I mean, you know, weeds come, but I guess the definition of a weed is that, you know, the plant's going to take resources from your crop, but there are ones you can leave in there that are complementary that would maybe keep the soil temperature right or keep it insulated, but allow the main crop to grow.
Yeah, so there's certainly been some evidence that farmers can intercrop with certain species that would enhance the cash crop, basically providing all the benefits of a cover crop to the field during the production season. Alternatively, it's been a traditional practice in many parts of the world to rotate so that your field is covered during the summertime, during the production season, with a cover crop. So you're specifically not growing a cash crop, you're growing nutrients for the next year's cover crop, or sorry, the next year's cash crop. And that system works really well if land isn't a scarce resource. So where we are, where farmers struggle to have enough land to stay in production because real estate prices are so high, it's really challenging to have enough land to do that type of rotation. But certainly that is a well-documented strategy that works.
Well, on larger farms, could there be areas set aside that our cover crop at the same time, you know, let's say last year they grew wheat on it. This year now it's cover crop, and then another field last year had cover crop, now it's wheat. Can they rotate around their farm in different parcels to get it done? That's
exactly what I'm talking about. A rotation that would include a cover crop or what we would call as a green manure crop. So it's a crop that you're specifically growing to produce nitrogen for the next cash crop. So yeah, diversifying through a rotation is a really effective tool.
Well, for smaller farms, what if, you know, there was a buddy system? This year I'm growing XYZ and you're growing ABC, and then we're going to literally, you know, next year I'm going to do cover crop, you're going to do that, and then we'll, I mean, could you switch dirt? Or is that absurd? Like, you know, for smaller farms, like literally swapping, you know, the top 8 inches of topsoil, would that be even possible? Or is that crazy?
You mean actually move the soil?
Yeah, if I had a buddy and, like I said, we agreed to a complementary schedule where I grow, you know, ABC 1 year, he grows XYZ, and then we switch it.
Yeah.
Or we swap soil, which might be crazy. But.
Yeah, I don't think the swapping soil would be great for soil health. That might be detrimental, but I think the idea of coordinating the land that you have in production with your neighbors is a great one. Certainly one of the issues that all farmers face is the issue of labor and trying to make sure that they've got the labor requirements for the crops that they're growing. So yeah, if there was a way that they could coordinate so that some of their land is in green manures during the production season, yeah, that could, seems like it could work. You know, there's some details there that would need to be ironed out.
Okay, well, what other strategies can improve soil health? Like, I guess backing up, I should have asked you in the beginning, what are the metrics of soil health to you or that are commonly agreed upon?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because the last part is sort of the critical part, that what metrics are commonly agreed upon. Well, there isn't a great consensus out there of what indicators should be used for soil health. There's been some recent efforts to really sort of tackle that one to make sure that we are all working from the same playbook when we're determining what is a healthy soil. But yeah, the indicators can range from physical, biological, or chemical. And really, given the complexity of the soil ecosystem, it's probably important to have some indicators from each of those categories to make sure that you've got some indication of the biological health, such as the amount of organisms that are in your soil or the diversity of those organisms, which are really the drivers of nutrient cycling and determine the structure of the soil. So then the physical components might be how dense your soil is or how compacted it is. That's a typical indicator. Chemical indicators would be, how much nitrogen or carbon is in your soil. That really gives you a sense of the organic matter. The organic matter is often one that's suggested as sort of the monolithic indicator, the one that can, if you had to pick one, you would point to organic matter because it's connected to so many of the other indicators, whether they're biological, physical, or chemical.
Well, why not look at biological indicators? Because that's what enables the nitrogen cycle and the bacteria. I mean, why not look at like earthworms per cubic foot, or bacteria strains per cubic foot? Why not sample that instead?
Yeah, so I mean those are great indicators. That's certainly something that we measure when we go out and do assessments. The thing that is challenging is to make the indicators something that farmers can quickly and easily do at a scale that's relevant to their production. So, it takes us about a half an hour to dig a pit, sort through the earthworms, count them up, enter the data. That's for one site, for one pit. If we were to try to do that for a 10,000 acre farm, that would be months of work. So being able to have an indicator or a suite of indicators that the farmers can go out and sample across the area that they're working in and do that repeatedly over time is really important. So it's not just about how good the indicator is in showing us that the soil is healthy. It's making sure that the farmers can actually go out and do it.
Well, are there any non-invasive ways? Like, maybe this is ridiculous, but could you use ground penetrating radar? Would that show you anything? If you shine certain light on the soil surface, would that tell you anything? Are there, again, any non-invasive ways to image so you can do multiple sites in a farm and not even disturb anything, but get an idea of what's going on?
Oh yeah, for sure. And that's part of the research that we're working on right now. So yeah, one of the less invasive ways of assessing a soil would be to go out and just take a core and select points across a farm field and then take them back to the lab, analyze them using various laboratory techniques that can be quite expensive. But what we're working on is trying to develop a relationship between some of those traditional laboratory techniques and a spectral signature from the surface of the soil. So we take that sample of soil and we run it with the traditional expensive laboratory technique. And we also run it using a mid-infrared spectrometer. And we get a sense of what the spectral indicators are of that soil. And we can actually develop a relationship, a mathematical relationship between what we analyzed in the lab and what we analyzed with the spectra. And what is the potential? Well, one outcome of that is that we're able to process way more soil for the same amount of price and effort than we did before. So using this spectral approach, it's about 10% of the cost of the traditional approach to analyzing soil. And we're actually finding that the spectral approach can be used for many different indicators at the same time. So, you know, that cost that I just quoted you actually might go down as we get better at associating or building these mathematical relationships between the spectra and other indicators. And
you know, what would probably be best is if you mount a device that can do some spectral analysis to the harvesting equipment itself, then yes. It's not wasting any time as it runs over the fields. It looks and looks and looks and looks and maps out, you know, what it sees over your fields.
That's exactly what the holy grail is, to be able to have mid-infrared spectrometer being integrated into the farm field equipment and being dragged behind, being able to relay that to the onboard GPS and to determine how much fertilizer needs to be applied to specific parts of the field based on the nutrient content that's being supplied by that spectral sensor. We're still a little ways out from having that technology in place. You know, there are a number of labs that are working on that. We're getting better at that. One of the major barriers is that the spectral response is very dependent on soil moisture. So one of the things that we do is when we bring it back to the lab, we dry down the soil so that it's a consistent zero or close to zero moisture. The soil looks very different when it's wet. And so getting it so that those instruments out in the field can deal with the wet soil is an active area of intensive research right now.
What about spectral analysis of stems and things like that, or the produce, the vegetable, or the fruit, you know, or the grain? Can you do a spectral analysis on the plants themselves right before harvest or at harvest?
Yeah, so that's another area that we've been working in, as using remote sensing. So we've used drones and satellite imagery, drones to capture remote sensed imagery and satellites to capture remote sense imagery. And from that imagery, we're able to build relationships to either healthy plants or healthy soil to be able to map differences across the landscape, or in the case of the drone imagery, across a field. So, you know, the healthy plants are greener than the unhealthy plants. And so we can tell where the soil is either nutrient poor or otherwise limiting the productivity of the plant. And there's a number of researchers right now who are working on trying to do that at a much higher resolution to enable in-field management of plants, whether it's for nutrients or for pest management. So yeah, it's very exciting and interesting area.
Yeah, I would think, you know, have you reviewed footage? I'm sure you have, you know, like rastering over a whole field. You know, how heterogeneous is it? Let's say the greenness or the apparent nutrient levels. If you apply different light filters, UV, infrared, you know, visible, and then you raster over a field, you know, how much variation is there? What's noticed?
Yeah, I mean, what from the human eye looks like a homogeneous field, just a, you know, a solid field of corn, can be very, very heterogeneous when you look at it through the eyes of a sensor that has something like, you know, hundreds of bands of wavelengths. So there are people now using hyperspectral imagery to really tease out some of that heterogeneity across the field. And we know that soils are incredibly different from, you know, in just a few meters distance. And so, yeah, we're able to with these technologies really tease out some of that really complex spatial differences.
Okay. What other methods are being contemplated to evaluate, you know, maybe non-invasively fields?
I mean,
or is that plenty? If it is, it's okay.
I think all of those methods that I just mentioned all have, you know, different nuances to the questions that they're trying to address. Yeah. So, you know, we're looking at different ways of using imagery from the back of a tractor to a drone to a satellite to be able to manage the agricultural system in a more efficient way. But yeah, there's a lot of details that need to get worked out to make that effective.
Okay. Other metrics for soil health that you're looking at, you know, that maybe a totally different approach is being used?
I don't think my lab is working on something that unique in any way. I think we're trying to build our overall understanding of these types of technologies in different systems that would otherwise not be used. So, you know, we're working in the Lower Fraser Valley of British Columbia, where we have some very intensive production systems that I would say are different than other places in the world, and that we've got vegetables and blueberries and dairy and dense forest all sort of intermixed throughout a very productive river valley. I think it's, yeah, our techniques aren't necessarily different than what folks in other parts of the world are developing.
Okay. Well, what's the best way for people to find out more about your research? Where can they go?
Yeah, we have a website, the Sustainable Agricultural Landscapes Lab. If you Google that, the SAL Lab, it should come up. We've got most of our project results up there, and hopefully in a way that's digestible to the general public and farmers who hopefully this is useful for.
Okay, well, very good. Sean, thank you for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for your time.
Before you stop listening, ask yourself, what are one or two useful things you heard on this podcast that can help you overcome food and fertilizer shortages, skyrocketing prices, the cost of living, or your job being outsourced overseas or eliminated due to automation? Please like and subscribe and tell your friends and family about their Surviving Hard Times podcast. We're all going to need help now and in the near future.